lesson two, and so I'm glad you're here. I think the book of Nehemiah is just so very interesting, and it's so relevant to us today, especially when we're carrying this idea of the theme of the book about rebuilding walls. Of course, we're going to use that thing figuratively because there's breaches in many walls around us, in our culture, in our nation, in our families, in the church, in our personal lives. And when we talk about walls, what are we talking about?
Barriers.
Barriers or else? What else?
Roadblocks.
Roadblocks, yes.
Protection.
All right. From that which we don't want to get inside. And isn't there a lot of things that's infiltrated our lives, our country, that look, what is going on? So they're boundaries, aren't they? That's what a wall can be, a boundary. We don't allow things to pass through, or we don't cross over ourselves. In our marriages, right? Don't you need walls of protection around your marriage? And so in an unwalled city was vulnerable to anyone that would come in and take what they wanted from it. And that's been Jerusalem for, you know, around 100 years. They've not addressed the wall. They attempted it once, as we saw last week, and that was failed by just some minor opposition. So even though they've rebuilt the temple, sacrifice has been reinstated, there's been worship, the walls are just laying in disrepair. And the 12 gates around Jerusalem, well, they stand burned. And that's where we left last week when Nehemiah was made aware of that. And we find that the summary of what happened in chapter 1 all the way through chapter 2 and verse 9 is where we left off. First down, he sat down and wept. Remember that? So here's some steps. You know, we got to sit down and weep over that which is broken. Because if we don't have a burden for it and a real passion, we'll never be committed to fixing it. Second of all, what did he do? Well, yeah, that was the weeping. But what did he do? He prayed. That's when he fasted. In other words, you got to go to the right source to get the right help. He prayed to God, and we remember, how many days?
Many.
And does anyone remember how many was? We studied that last week.
152.
Yeah, it was like 4 months. And how long did it take to build the walls?
53 days.
He spent a lot more time in praying to God than they did in work. Success is going to be finding it in God. And then he acknowledged his position, because it says at the end of chapter 1, and I was cupbearer to the king. Well, what are you going to do? What do you know about such kind of construction? Are you a project manager, an engineer? What kind of background do you have? So it doesn't matter. I have a relationship with the king, and I'm going to go in there and ask him for help. So he prayed for success, didn't he? So he went in there, and I have this last point, leveraging your relationships. Did he take a bold move asking the king for time off, letters of authority, to go down and secure the timbers and protection, and to go down there and buy it? And now, what did he not ask the king to do? And you made this point last week, which I thought was very profound. Well?
He didn't ask the king to do it. He asked himself to do it.
Did you hear that? He didn't come to the king and say, look, king, my country's in disarray. That the walls are torn down. Could you go down there and fix it? No. He didn't ask someone else to do it. He asked for permission to go do it himself. Isn't that interesting? I thought that was very important to point out. So that was last week, and now we're in lesson 2, and it's going to cover chapter 2, verse 10, or actually 11, all the way through the end of chapter 3. We won't be able to deal with chapter 3 in its entirety because of time, but I want you to read it, and we'll give it a quick overview. And we're going to see in this lesson, Nehemiah is going to make a careful assessment of the work that needs to be done. Because you can't do the work if you don't know what actually needs to be done. Then second of all, he's going to invite other people to join him. That's very key. And then thirdly, we're going to find the priests were the first to volunteer. And the high priest is mentioned as working. What does that teach us before we get there? If the leaders aren't willing to work, will the job get done? And will there be success? And we're going to find it started from the top down. And then finally, all the families are going to be included. Everybody could do something. And it's very interesting, some of the people and their professions that are mentioned, how they chipped in and worked it as well. So now we're going to find ourselves in chapter 9, just to catch ourselves, or chapter 1, verse 9, to transition into this lesson. So look there in verse 9. He says, if you return to me and keep... Oh, that's not right. That's not verse 9. Oh, chapter 2. Yeah. I knew what I was doing. I was in the wrong chapter. Verse 9 of chapter 2. Then I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river. What river would that be? Euphrates. All right. And they gave them the king's letters. Now the king has sent with me officers and the army and the horsemen for protection. Then Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about it. It was very displeasing to them that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. We're going to find a resistance from within the camp right from the beginning. Now, let me ask this. It's obvious. But did the opposition come when he was grieving? No. Did it come when he was praying? Did it come when he was making the request? When did it come? When it says, I came. When he actually is doing something, people, what are you here for? What are these soldiers here for? What are these letters? Now you're going to get opposition. People could care less about talk. They could care less about us, you even protesting, because there's a big difference between talking and doing, isn't there? And when you start doing, that's when you're always going to get opposition. And I'm talking about spiritually, most of all. And we talked about that briefly last week. Jesus promised it. That if they persecuted me, they're going to persecute you. Because if we're of light, living in a dark world, people are going to try to put out the light. And the hardest thing to get used to as a Christian, I can't say that. I'm speaking for myself. One of the hardest things for me to get used to as a Christian is dealing with conflict from without and then within. Because I just get this idea that, you know, everyone's going to love the Lord. Everyone's going to love peace. Everyone's going to love loving, right? And so when you get people resisting and pushing back, it makes you first question what? Yourself. Am I doing what's right? Maybe I'm one that's wrong. And then after a while, you get comfortable. No, it is true. What I'm doing is right. And the reason people object and resist is because there is just evilness and evil in the world, isn't there? They did it to Jesus, they're going to do it to us. So 800 miles, he is committed, isn't he? And that's where we find out what happens. Now, let's read this next section. We'll make some comments about it. Because here's about the idea of assessment. Verse 11. So I came to Jerusalem, and I was there 3 days. And I rose in the night, so this is going to be a secret mission, and a few men with me. I didn't tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind. How do you think he did that? Don't know. But he's been praying, hadn't he? But he says, this is God's job, not his own. That's important for you to know. What God was putting in my mind to do for Jerusalem, and there was no animal with me except the animal which I was riding. What does that mean? Why would he say that? What was not with him? He didn't have a security detail, people on horseback, right? He's all by himself going out by night because it's going to be just a clandestine assessment. So I went out at night by the valley gate in the direction of the dragon's well onto the refuse gate. We're going to mention these later. Inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. Verse 14. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. So I went up at night by the ravine, inspected the wall, then I entered the valley gate again and returned. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done, nor as I had yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work. So here we see his inspection, or he's going to make assessment, surveying the wall, because I want to know what needs to be done. A couple things I want to point out to you. The word inspecting, It's a medical term for probing a wound to see the extent of its damage. When you're doing triage, you're trying to figure out who you're going to treat first, the most severe. Say, this guy's got a broken leg, it's sticking out. They take him in, and what does the doc do? He goes in there and he does a careful inspection, see if there's bleeding or what's going on and how many legs, you know, bones, how it's broken. They always make careful assessment. That's what he's doing here. So surveying, yeah, we've got to build this wall. It's down this far. We're going to need this block, this many workers here. We're going to need timbers here for this gate. You can see what he's doing. Now he's doing it by the secrecy of night, right? Then the darkness, just with a few men with him. And then notice his the assessment. Of course, we know the walls are broken and the gates are burned. But he doesn't tell us more than that, except he just makes us circumference around the city doing this careful assessment. Then we find out that no one knows. So I'm going to ask the question, why the secrecy? Yes.
Well, if he's wanting to evaluate what he really has, he doesn't want people to put a show or to change any of the circumstances of what he's actually seeing.
Okay.
So, you know, if you keep everybody away, you get a true fact.
Going to get an honest assessment. He didn't want to be done to repeat what he's saying, so everyone know because everyone is going to be involved. Will there be some people that want to sugarcoat the problem? All right? And other people want to maybe make it worse than it is. All right? And we'll come back to that idea. Yes?
Well, with what Bruce was saying, if he's going to lead the reconstruction of the wall, he had to assess, as you said, inspect and make sure that he, first of all, if he's going to be leading this, knows what the requirements are, how much is going to be needed. And the only way to do that and to lead it is to make that careful assessment.
All right.
So he's going to come back with the knowledge without them knowing that he has done that.
So they can't sugarcoat it over. Yeah, Eva?
Well, and he doesn't want the enemies to know what he's doing either.
Yeah, he doesn't want opposition. So he's doing this privately so he can get things in motion before they can ramp up against him. Is that what you're going to say?
Because he already knows about the opposition.
Uh-huh.
And so he wants to get the lay of the land first.
Okay.
And prepare for that.
All right, and in this kind of mission, what also you learn about, it's very personal. Isn't it? This is Nehemiah's burden. He's going to spearhead it, so he wants to know intimately what needs to be done. He's not asking others to do it. He's personally involved, all right? And so, and that's why you'll see the words when he talks to the nobles and leaders. He says, we. He doesn't say you. We. And so it's very personal to him. It's his job, his mission. Yeah.
He did that. I'm sure with Nehemiah, he's given him abilities in order to not only properly assess, but then to recalculate and to do that. And I'm sure God's working with him.
Maybe. You said his God's good hand was with him, but to how that played out, yeah.
One of the things that I see absent here is he went through this whole area and wasn't challenged once, which tells me there was
yeah. There's no guards on the wall, are there? Yeah.
Yeah. If this is my city, I'd be wanting to see it protected somehow.
And we're going to ask a question why that is. It's interesting. Some only focus on what is good. Is that true in all life? And they're deceiving themselves that all is well. And we say, well, whoa. That's the person the cup is always half full, right? I say always, because sometimes the cup is half empty, isn't it? Now, what is the kind that's always positive and is blinded to the problems around us? They're living in with rose-tinted glasses. They don't allow themselves to see the problems that are at hand. Why would some people be like that? Because they don't want to feel accountability, maybe? Is that what you're saying? Oh, and if you don't know what's wrong, then you don't have to respond. That's all. So you live in this gilded cage. Yes? Anybody else? What? Have you ever done that and met someone like that? Everything's perfect. Everything's fine. A lot of times when you bring up things that are a problem, people get defensive because they think, well, you're pointing fingers at them. No, we're not pointing fingers. Just we got a problem here. We're not casting blame. Now, does Nehemiah cast any blame in any of these discussions? I just want you to ask the question as we read through it. He never is pointing finger. He's not being critical. Because some people only see what is wrong, don't they? There's some people that are good Monday morning quarterbacks. They'll tell you why the team lost the game on Saturday or Sunday, right? They'll tell you the coach was an idiot. The quarterback, I could play better than him. They can tell you everything the team did wrong. Have you met someone like that? They always can diagnose and lay out the church and say, here's what's wrong with the elders, here's what's wrong with the preacher, and here's what's wrong with all the members and that woman over there. And they'll just lay it all out and diagnose it, like, see how smart I am? And they've just decimated the church, chopped it up, and they walk away patting their back. And it just bleeding there. And I can say that because I've done that. Never offering a solution, but always quick to tell what's wrong. Now, some people are really good at that. They're always critical. They're quick to criticize. Now, is Nehemiah either of those? Is he bold enough to look at the walls and see what the problem is? And is he brave enough to say, we're going to do something about it? And that's what seems so marvelous about him. He's not on one side or the other. That he can look at the facts and devise a solution, because you can't come up with a plan if you don't know what the problem is. If we're not honest enough to look at it or just don't see it for what it is. He'll devise a plan, then he's going to rise up to action. That's what we're going to see. So that's why he's going out at night. He's starting, he wants to create a vision, and then he's going to share that vision with others, and as they begin to own it, man, this amazing things happen. Yes. Yes.
These three guys, Sanballat, Tobiah, and...
Yes.
Tried everything they could think of. Nothing.
Yes, we're going to see their names come up later. Yeah, they're going to be persistent.
Were they kings of another place?
We'll save that for a second, but they're... I have it coming up, I believe, the answer to that.
We need to rebel against the king.
Yeah. They ask that question, are you rebelling against the king? Because they're ignorant. They don't know Nehemiah's coming with the king's authority. So when they ask that question, they don't even know what they're saying. It's interesting. Proverbs says this, whoever has no rule over his own spirit, that's self-control, is like a city broken down without walls. What is that saying about a person? If they can't control their temper or their spirit or their desires or whatever, you're like an unguarded city. Yeah, you're subject to being led by anyone that comes along or just provokes you or, yes, you're an unguarded person. And I say that because on a personal level, do we have to be brave enough to make assessment of our own lives? To look at ourselves and say, are there things I need to honestly fix? Are there things I really need to work on? Is that difficult to do, to look in the mirror? It's extremely difficult because, first of all, I get it's defensive. No, I didn't. I didn't do everything perfect. You know, that's my attitude, right? And so it's difficult to do that. Is it hard to do it when we're looking at the church? Now, again, some people are quick to always talk negatively about the church. My first point is, when you're talking about the church, you're talking about yourself. That's the first point we want to make, right? It's not they or those guys. When you talk about the local congregation, who are you speaking about?
Yourself.
So be careful. Anything you say about those guys, you're talking about yourself because you're part of it. Is that not true? That's why they say when you point the finger, you know, three are pointing back at you. Yes.
You're also talking about God's kingdom.
That's the second thing. The church, 1 Corinthians 3, is the temple of God. And it says, he who destroys the church, God will destroy him. That's pretty strong language. God does not take lightly for people cutting up the church, just dissecting, being critical, without offering a
solution.
So here is going to be my first suggestion. Bring your analysis of what we could do better. suggest where we're falling short. But don't bring the solution or the problem unless you have a solution. Is that fair? Because that shows you have the heart of Nehemiah. You made careful assessment with the intention, here's what we can do to make it better. Is that a good idea? And if you say, well, I don't know what to do better. Well, then counsel with someone before you start broadcasting all the problems. Because there's nothing that will cause a church to lose enthusiasm and energy than people that complain and run down the brethren. Isn't that true? It can just destroy just the spirit of a congregation, of a family, or even of a country. So does that mean we stick our head in the sand? No. Come up with a solution and couple it to the problem that you detect. Is that fair? All right. So I have to make honest assessment. No exaggeration, because often we can make things appear worse than they are or better than they are. And usually it's somewhere where? In the middle. Okay? So would you think that we could do a better job at evangelism in this area? So what if I said, we're terrible at evangelism. We just don't, no one's being saved here in Salem. What have I just done?
Exaggerated.
And made it worse, and it made people feel terrible, but it's not true, right? It's not true. Yes?
I know what other people are doing.
Well, even in this congregation, I know it's happened. There's people been brought to the Lord. So to say no and never, those are exaggerating words, right? So, but always have an attitude, I'm bringing this up because we want to act and make it better. I love the words of Paul about when he talks to the Thessalonians about love and hope and faith. He says, you're doing these things, but I want you to excel still more. Get better even at it. So it's always with a mind to act, to make things better. So again, no solution, no comment. I think that's a good rule to go by, even in a marriage, right? Before you bring up a problem, think about a solution. So then it comes across as positive, doesn't it? Rather than just complaining. All right? Sure? You want to talk about your wife? with this being said, this one here. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I said I did a fair amount of research of the condition of the Lord's church right now. And this article chronicles, here it says attendance is down 7.8% from 1990, even though our United States population is increased by 90 million or something like that. There's a problem. When it comes to youth that leave the church, like going off to college or just grow up and become adults, 50% of them are falling away from the faith. An average of 200 churches fold every year, just quit. I mean, because they get gray-haired and there's no more members and they just fold up. And so the question is, why? Now, it's easy to point fingers. Well, people aren't preaching. They're not sharing the gospel enough. There's a lot of factors. Because when you look across the board, of all the denominations, they're all decreasing. Did you know that? So it has something to do with our culture and the society in which we live. There's the first connection. So it's not just about us. It's something about the culture in which we live, all right? But that's not fair just to put it off of that and walk away, because we still have our head in the sand if we just don't make careful assessment. Because our children are under our control until they leave home. So where is the direct correlation to them staying faithful or not? It's the parents. 100% it starts with this. Well, no, the culture around us sucks them into the world. Who's in charge of our child while they're growing up in those formative years? I am. He said, well, what can you do different? That's where we have to make careful assessment and come up with good solutions. Because if we're losing half of our kids, as soon as we raise them up in the church, they leave and go off on their own. Something we're doing isn't working. Because it hasn't always been 50%. Another factor is we're having less babies. Is that true? People are getting married later years and having less babies or no babies at all. Does that affect the population in the Lord's church? Yes. But that's interesting. That's not church growth through evangelizing. That's just from within. I mean, you're evangelizing your child, don't get me wrong. But it's a different kind of evangelizing, isn't it? And a lot of churches are growing, but it's really transfers. So is that really growing? For you to increase, another congregation has to decrease. So the number stays the same. Elders. A lot of congregations don't have elders anymore. A lot of churches are getting so smaller, they can't afford a minister full time. Now, when you don't have a preacher or a teacher who can dedicate themselves, what happens to the level of teaching? Often, it starts to decline. And then we start this cycle, right? Downward. Now, making critical assessment requires also then a critical solution. Now, that's not the purpose of our class right now. But where is this congregation going to be in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years? Because many of the whiter-haired people won't be with us. And how many children do we have in the back on a Wednesday night? They used to be full on Wednesday nights, didn't they? But that number's been decreasing as well, hasn't it? So what's going to happen in 5, 10 years? If we're aware of what's going to happen and we make good plans now, we can reverse it and make it go the other way. So I didn't want to spend a lot of time on it. I just want to suggest that this is nationwide, this issue. So it's not just something I'm bringing up here. All right? It's interesting. The largest growing population segment of our society are Hispanics. There are like 70 million in the United States, the last I read. And yet they're the smallest part of the growth in the church. But yet, overall, they tend to be the most religious. Largest growing population sector, but the least evangelized. But yet the most religious or spiritual minded. So there's a lot of things when I'm saying take a careful assessment. There's lots of things we can look at from our families to our children to our classes to everything we're doing so we can excel still better. It's not to be critical. It's not to be make people defensive. It's just we always have to be in this constant assessment of what we're doing so we can always get better. Because it's always fluid. It's dynamic, isn't it? A church always changes. Was that a hand or a yawn? All right. Yeah.
So the word church discipline, we think punitive so far.
Right.
But it goes back to relationships, which goes back to this subject tonight, which we talked last week about passion, how we've lost our passion. And a lot of that goes back to building those relationships first, which is why I think Nehemiah took 4 months. We talked about him building this in 52 days. Really, he prayed for 4 months, and during that time period, what was he doing? He was building trust, he was building care before he went and challenged the people to say, hey, this is what we're going to do. So, in other words, managers tell people what to do, leaders get involved and say, hey, let's go do this together.
And we'll see that.
And that's what he did.
And we'll see that.
Without being so corrective, he went along next to them and said, this is what we're going to do. That built relationships, that built passion, that built growth.
And then we'll see that in how he approaches the leaders, because you're exactly right. He's very tactful and wise, and he's not managing. He's asking them to join him in this good work. So he said to them, first of all, there's got to be acknowledgement, though. You see, he's asking them to acknowledge the problem. You see the bad situation we are. There's no sugarcoating, but notice it includes the plural. We are in. It's not you guys. What are you doing here? 100 years, you haven't built a wall? What's wrong with you? He includes himself as part of it. You with me? So it's not critical and finger pointing. It's about, oh, we're in a problem here. Because Jerusalem is desolate and its gates are burned by fire. That's pretty strong language. So then there's the invitation. Come, come, let. And then what is it's a plural pronoun. Let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so we'll be no longer be a reproach. Let me just suggest this. This is not about wall building, is it? Let's restore and build the wall so we'll no longer be a reproach. Who's the first of all that's being shamed and is reproached by this Jerusalem being in disrepair? God. Because people are talking about the nation of Israel and God's their God. What kind of God they have? They let this happen and look at them and the disrepair they've had for all these years. And of course, they become a byword now too. So it's more than just build. It's not about wall building. It's about something bigger. And then when the only way we'll be successful in any endeavor, whether it's in our marriage or family, when we make it bigger than just ourselves. It's not about converting someone. It's about saving a soul, right? Isn't there a big difference? Converting someone to Christ and saving a soul? Well, it's the same thing. No, the whole motivation is totally different, isn't it? One's personal and making an eternal difference in their life. The other one's just adding a number to the congregation, right? So that's what he does. Let's rebuild the wall so we'll no longer be a reproach. So then he tells them, and this is how he shares the vision, how the hand of my God had been favorable to me and about the king's words which had spoken to me. So what do you think he included in that? I heard the report. I fasted and prayed for those 4 months period. I went and talked to the king and I asked God to give me success with the king. The king quizzed me and said, what do you want? And he gave it to me. And God's good hand was upon me. Does that get them excited? Because they realize this is not about, I'm not asking you to trust me, Nehemiah says. I'm asking you to realize this is God's work. Trust God. He's going to make it happen. So that's the third thing we understand. There has to be acknowledgement of what the issue is at hand. And then there's going to have to be a sharing of the vision. But you've got to realize if this is not God's work, it's going to fail, right? But if it is God's work, it cannot fail. Didn't we read that in Acts chapter 4 when they had the apostles? And they said, whoa, 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 many guys arose up like this. And if it's not of God, it'll go away like the rest. But if it's of God, be careful lest you find yourself what? Fighting against God himself. But if you're doing it for God. So he shares all that. How the hand of my God had been with me. And here it is. Here's their response. They said, let us arise and build. That's amazing. Because they could have said, I'll give you one of three things. Not needed. Hey, this wall has been down for 100 years since we've come back. And hey, we're getting along just fine. We don't need to rebuild the walls. Is that some people's attitude? Why rock the boat? Things are just fine, status quo, when really they're not. Okay? They could have said that, but they didn't. They could have said, oh, you're crazy, man. We can't do that. It's too big of a job. These are big walls, too. We'll talk about that later. It's too hard. We're just a bunch of people that are refugees. And they could have said, no, the enemies are too big and powerful. There's too much opposition. You're crazy. But he did a good job, maybe relationship building, but he sold the vision and they said, let's do it. So that leads us to these fellas then, Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite. They came and they mocked us. Despise us. How does opposition begin before it becomes physical? Destroy your morale. Oh, your morale, right. Just your willingness and your spirit and your enthusiasm. you can't do this. You guys are crazy. And so they despised us. And actually, from all outward appearance, it does look perhaps kind of silly, right? And they said, what are you doing, rebelling against the king? So it shows how ignorant they are, because are they rebelling against the king?
No.
No, he's coming with the king's authority and approval. He has letters to prove it, all right? So it's interesting. Tobiah is a Jewish name, was a man of influence who is associated with the high priest family and getting help from the priest, Nehemiah chapter 13. This is such an indictment against this person. Of all people who should have been chipping in, it should have been him. And so will opposition sometimes come from within? Isn't that sad? Same thing about this guy named Sanballat. He was connected by marriage to the priestly families. We learned that. And an ancient document from this period refers to Sanballat as governor of Samaria. So he's in charge of northern Galilee area. And so he wants to hang on to his power. And he's more interested in that than rebuilding and restoring Jerusalem to its former glory. Well, I love Nehemiah's answer, because he understands who is with him and who's against him. Because the key is, we got to learn to work with those who are going to work. And then what do we do with the rest? Nothing. Just work with those that are going to work. Sometimes they will be naysayers and try to run us down. Sometimes they'll just sit on the sideline and do nothing. But what do? Just nothing. Work with those who are going to work. Now, how many is that going to be in a given congregation? Is it the 80-20 rule? I don't know. It could be 50-50, but it doesn't matter. He said, the God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, will rise. I'm going to work with those that want to work and build. But you've got no part in this. How does he know they have no part? They've just stated as much, right? So we're just going to let you go on your own. They're drawing a line. We're just going to work with those work. You guys just do your own thing. Now, it's going to get more serious later. But you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem. They've cut themselves off. Wow. That's discipline too, isn't it? So with that being said, we're in chapter 3. And look at it with me real quickly. Notice how it's broken down. So verse 1, Elisha the high priest arose with his brothers. And next to him, verse 2, the men of Jericho built. And next to them, Zachariah the son of Imri built. Verse 3, now the sons of Hasanah built the fish gate. So he's going to mention these gates. There's 12 of them around the walls of Jerusalem. And he names the men, for us to read here these thousands of years later, of those who built it and rose up. And verse 4, next to them, Meremoth, the son of Uriah. So he rises up with the sons of Hasanah in verse 3 to build the fish gate. So he mentions in each paragraph which gate's being built and the section of wall between that and the next gate and the associated people that are working with it. You see that? That's all the whole chapter is. You go, that's it? What is there to learn? Well, let's point some things out. First of all, who's the first guy mentioned? The high priest. I mentioned that earlier. That's so important. That you got to have the leadership involved. Now, the high priest, he's too important to get his hands dirty building a wall, right? Or a gate. He's probably the most important person to be getting his hands dirty, to set an example for the rest. With his brothers, the priests, and they built the sheep gate. Here's a picture of what they think it was. They consecrated it. Now, all that means is they set it apart and said, this is for God. This is not just a gate for us. We're doing this for God. Do you see any verse in the New Testament that says, everything you do, make sure you do it for God? Which one? Huh? Wow, you looked at my slide. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord. What does that mean? You're doing it for God. It's not about building gates or building walls. If you're raising a child and raising a family or going to work, what are you doing? Everything. It's all consecrated. It's all for the Lord, because you're using this opportunity to let people glorify God by your good works and how you conduct yourself in this life. So either we bring him shame or we bring him glory. So notice it. They consecrated the wall of the Tower, 100, and the Tower of the Hanel. Next to them, the men of Jericho built. Next to them, Zachar, the son of him, built. Guess what? Built the fish gate. Made repairs. The word repairs is used 35 times. What is this all about? Building, restoring, repairing. It's all about action. Maybe that's the biggest clue of getting things done, is actually doing something. It's all about work, effort. And we're going to see who is doing it. Yes?
Well, the big thing, again, I think that you pointed to very correctly was with the leadership. When you look at the high priest and the role in which they played with the children of Israel, like Aaron and whatever, they listened to the high priest. And when he's out there actually working, that's somebody that the people want to follow. So they would fall in line. And
yeah.
That's obviously what happened here.
That's right. When Ann and I first came to Salem, we drove by that restaurant that's always closed because it changes hand and closes right there on Liberty and...
It's across from the Grand...
The Grand... Phoenix. What's it called? Yeah. It used to be an IHOP. Does anyone know where that one is? Long time ago. I don't even know what it is now. It's nothing. The reason I met that, because Jim Carnes and Ray Tipton met with me there the very first time. And Ray Tipton was an elder, and he's not here now, but where's one place you always find Ray when it comes to work? Where? Huh? No, outside this building. Huh? What kind of work am I thinking of? I wonder if you think of the same thing. Moving. If someone's moving, where was Ray, our elder? At the end, it was that way, just carrying the lightest things. Yeah. Ray, what are you doing here? Well, I can do something. It's always what he said. He was always there to just the last few years. All right? Yeah, so. He always beat us to the hospital. He couldn't get there quick enough. Ray found out without a cell phone or text message. You go, someone's in the hospital. I got to go. And he's there before us. All right? All right. Interesting. Verse 4, Jodiah the son of... Oh, I've skipped one. End of verse 4, is it? The nobles did not support the work of their masters. Doesn't name it. Imagine Nehemiah might have wanted to put down their names, and he didn't. But no, just the nobles. Sometimes the leaders will, but the real elite, sometimes, no. I can't get my fingers dirty. All right? Here is the old gate. It lists all the people by name. Shallum, he and his daughters. Uzziah the... Is that his trade, being a gate builder? What is he? He's a jeweler. Is this his profession? No, but can he do some work? His daughters, the Shallum, he and his daughters, yeah, same way. Hanan and the inhabitants of Zanah repaired the valley gate. They hung its doors with bolts and bars. This guy, I can't even say his name, repaired the refuse gate. He built it and hung its bolts and bars. Here he did it. And all the other people that joined him. I forgot to mention the guy who was the perfumer. You know, what a profession. But now he's building walls. And so when we're all done, the repairs in front of them were made. They carried out repairs. And then finally, verse 31, they carried out repairs. The goldsmiths and these merchants and goldsmiths carried out repairs. It's all about what? Work, build. And it gets done. We're done. There's a picture of the walled city. Here's a person's a rendition of it. These are the gates. And I'll give you the names on a handout later. They surrounded the city, and that's how you got access into the city of Jerusalem. All right. Thank you very much.